is Jerry Pippin, and we have William Warwick with us. Actually, three W's and a fourth by your name. Is that right?
Wine Woman Whoopi. That's what.
And he's on the line for Virginia Beach, Virginia. And we've had William on the air many times before. In fact, he's been on a lot of people's air, including Nightline, the UFO Hunters, various radio shows, including ours. He's a producer of conferences and also co-director of a documentary, as well as the producer right now and the writer, The Phoenix Incident, Beyond the Phoenix Lights. And William, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to be back with you again.
You're going to have a big showing of this weekend in New York, huh? This documentary?
Absolutely. Our world premiere is going to be at the Village East Theater in New York for the New York Film and Video Festival, and we're really excited about that.
We're going to be talking in great detail here in a minute about that documentary. And a few other things. So you've got a lot of things going on. You've written some books too, I think. The Norfolk
Incident.
That's
correct. The Norfolk Incident and Phoenix Rising, which is sort of the sister book to the Norfolk Incident. And we're hoping to have both of those out by December of this year.
Now you got something coming up next year. I know you probably don't want to talk too much about it because it's still in the works. But you've got the Covenant of the Grail. What's that going to be about?
Well, during the investigation of all these different anomalous things, you come across a lot of information that seems to be very old and ancient, and you get into a lot of the Freemasons, Knights Templars, and some other related data that suggests to me that perhaps the great secret of these societies is not so much just that the lineage of Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene have lived on since he was allegedly crucified, but also that a lot of these secret information may have to do with the fact that these groups had interactions with extraterrestrials.
We're looking forward to that book, and that'll be a whole subject for a new show. Let's get back to this documentary for a moment. You've got a website here on this documentary, The Phoenix Incident, and we have a link to it. Tell us a little bit about what went into this documentary. What makes it different from the others?
Well, the Phoenix Incident is a documentary which records, and for historical purposes, and also, of course, for the documentary, the many different events that occurred on or about March 13, 1997. Unfortunately, one of the biggest problems that we've come across, a lot of investigators trying to investigate this event, is that there is more than just one event. And unfortunately, most of the attention has been applied towards the now infamous 9:20 p.m. video, which most researchers will probably agree that is nothing more than a flare drop. So our wanting to document all of these other stories and get them on historical record, so to speak, is the impetus behind all of this, because if you just go by that one video, you're not really getting the full story.
You have something called Sirius Seminars, I guess. That's about you got the name from the star.
Actually,
Sirius.
This video would not even be in existence if it wasn't for Carrie. She's been a tremendous help and support financially to get the video done. She helped me to get this video made, to put the conference together and all of that so that we could document all of this. And it's really kudos to her for putting up the money and having faith in me and the event itself to get this done.
So now, this documentary is available on DVD from your website, and we have a link to it.
Yes, absolutely. You can purchase the DVD from SiriusSeminars.com, or you can also get it at UFOEyewitness.com. And it's about $20 plus shipping and handling, and I guarantee you that if you haven't seen some new information in this DVD that you haven't seen anywhere else, then you can write me an email and yell at me. But I guararantee you that you will not be disappointed.
Now, when you have the showing this weekend in New York City, will this be the first time you've shown it to a live audience? I mean, other than just a few people looking at a DVD.
Exactly. No, it will be the first time. I believe the theater that we have is about 175 seats. You can purchase tickets from NewYorkFilmAndVideo.com, and this will be the first time that any audience, more than just a few people, have actually seen this. In April, we went to the X conference with Stephen Bassett, and we did give some promotional copies to a few researchers, Edgar Mitchell, Colonel Jesse Marcello Jr., Steve Bassett, so Canadian researchers as well, and the response from them was very good.
So you got some good feedback.
Absolutely. I mean, it really is a historical piece. One of the things that really frustrated me, or any researcher in investigating UFOs, is usually the lack of information. And if you take an incident like Roswell, and I spoke to Colonel Jesse Marcello about this at some length, you know, that event happened over 60 years ago. And Jesse was just a kid when that happened. And, you know, so much attention, so many books have been published about the Roswell incident, and there is so little actual information that we have to go by. And yet here you have the Phoenix incidents, plural, not just one event, but really should be plural, but it doesn't sound good in the title. You're looking at a number of events that happened prior to right on March 13th and for some time afterwards that indicates that we really were visited by some type of extraterrestrial civilization, and it caused pandemonium with the United States government.
So you think there was actual contact?
Oh, there's no question, yes. The evidence definitely supports that.
And that's in the documentary?
Well, the documentary is only 1 hour, so we had to, you know, just to give you an example, I mean, the Norfolk incident was originally 650 pages, and the Phoenix Rising is something similar to that. I had to condense a lot of information into one 60-minute video in order to be able to make it comprehensible. So we weren't able to include all the information that we wanted to, obviously, because of the time restraints. But I think we hit most of the main points that relate to the Phoenix incident. And just so that your listeners know, this is actually only going to be the first of many DVDs which will come. So you can really look at this as part one. And that's why part of the title is UFO Eyewitness Video Part 1, that documents the Phoenix Lights aspects of what happened that particular spring in 1997. But there are a lot of other events that we can get into great detail in this interview that we probably couldn't get into in the video.
Yeah, and we will. We just want to mention that's at the Village East Cinemas in New York, and the festival actually runs from September 19th on down to I think the 25th. I'm not sure what day your film is showing, or does it show more than one?
No, it's actually from 9 o'clock in the morning, 9 p.m. at night. There's lots of films to be seen. Our film is actually going to show at Saturday, September 20th at 2 p.m. We're very excited about that. That's, you know, prime time. We hope that it rains so that lots of people will come and get a look at it. There's also a short movie I haven't seen, it's not by us, called The Mars Project, which will be showing just before our film comes on, and we're very happy to have had that time slot. I mean, it's very fortuitous that we would get that time slot. We're hoping that we may be able to get an award for Best Documentary, so we're keeping our fingers crossed for that.
Well, we wish you luck on that. Let's talk a little bit about the Phoenix Light investigation, and I know you spent some time out there yourself, and you talked to Air Traffic Control.
Yep.
The new kind of radar they have, and they told you something very interesting.
Yeah, and actually this wasn't directly related to the Phoenix Lights. I have a construction business, and I come across all kinds of people from all walks of life. She told me, basically, she's retired now. I'm not going to say her name. I don't want any this to come back on her. But basically, she said that the radars, apparently the hardware and the software, within the past couple of years, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, was actually changed or modified so that it does not pick up UFOs. And her words, quote-unquote, were basically that if they hadn't done that, they'd be seeing them all the time, and it would cause, you know, pandemonium within ATC. There's no reason for this woman to have lied to me about this. It wasn't sort of related to the UFO investigation, so it wasn't like she would have made it up just to impress me or anything like that. And I believe that it's true.
You get that impression that we're talking about just not there in Phoenix, but other air traffic control centers?
Absolutely, there's no question. In fact, just to give you some idea of what was going on in the spring, not just the Phoenix Lights, but January 19th of 1997, which is just a few, maybe about 6 or 7 or 8 weeks prior to the Phoenix lights, NORAD allegedly contacted Brazilian Air Force, their counterpart in the Brazilian Air Force, to tell them that an object was going to crash in Brazil. And apparently there were some search teams sent out there, and there's a whole story that goes behind this of aliens that were captured and extraterrestrial biological entities that were taken to hospitals. And, you know, it's one thing to have a story about a light in the sky. It's quite another when you have military people from a foreign government, you know, basically telling you that, yes, this happened, and we can't talk about it.
Do you have a time frame?
Yeah, that was January 19th. The evening of January 19th through the 20th of 1997, and just a month after that, on February 19th, 1997, there was a major UFO flap at, I believe it was Petersburg Airport in Russia, and I believe that this is part of what precipitated the later on hurried summit that took place, actually, in the Pentagon's tank room, which is a super-secret room within the Pentagon, where the Prime Minister from Russia came and met with the National Security Council on March 16, 1997. I believe that that was a direct result of what happened in Petersburg, and also as a result of what happened, of course, on March 13th with the Phoenix incidents.
What do you piece together really happened here? I mean, you're talking about government contact, not only from our country but maybe others. And what is coming?
The $64,000 question. I've had 10 years to think about it. I've probably done more research on this than just about anyone else on the planet. I'm going to take a deep breath before I begin into this. This may be a lengthy discourse here, but from what I can gather, it appears that, despite all the objections that the skeptics will bring up, that apparently there was a object that was traveling on or behind or along with the Hale-Bopp comet, which was discovered on July 23rd, 1995. As this comet and the object that was apparently tagging along with it got closer and closer to the Earth, astronomers or military people began to conclude that the object which was traveling with it was in fact a UFO. And if you recall, a lot of the controversy with the Hale-Bopp comet was that at one point, allegedly, there were some photos of this object, and you had a slew of astronomers that came out and said, oh, you know, it wasn't that, it was this, and it was, you know, the amateur astronomer was wrong, and a great debate ensued. And of course, you have the the suicide of the March 27th, 1997, of the Heaven's Gate cult, which just threw the whole crazy factor into it, and did a lot to sort of quell any sort of investigation into the true anomalies that Hale-Bopp presented. One interesting thing that happened, which may indicate a conspiracy, is that the discoverer of Hale-Bopp, Mr. Hale, actually was killed in a car crash in, I believe it was June of 1997. So I don't know if you recall that movie. I don't know if it was Armageddon or the other one where they said the comet, you know, the asteroid was going to kill Earth. And the very beginning of the movie, the astronomer, you know, gets in his car and is driving down the road and has a car accident. He dies, and then no one knows the comet's coming or the asteroid's coming. It seems very strange to me that he also died in Alice Springs, Australia, which is where a huge monitoring facility of the National Security Agency is located, which tracks spaceborne objects. So, it appears to me that there, in fact, was, judging by the reaction of the government, around the time that the comet was supposed to be closest to the Earth, which was April, right around April 1st of 1997, that there, in fact, was a UFO/extraterrestrial sort of invasion, or maybe a visit, and that if you work from that hypothesis backwards and you look at the events that transpired, it certainly would explain the government's reactions to what was going on, as well as a lot of the missing or crashed planes and the people that were killed in the plane crashes. So it definitely appears that this, along with, and here's the wild card, there was a gamma ray burst that occurred on February 28, 1997, and it appears that not just one ET group was coming to visit us in 1997, but two ET groups. And the other ET group came, apparently the evidence or the propulsion system, for what I can gather, is the existence of these gamma ray bursts, which are the largest explosions for energy in the universe. Now, here's the Scuttlebutt. Apparently, and again, this is just my opinion, I cannot give you concrete evidence to say that this is true, although I've got a whole heck of a lot of circumstantial evidence which points to it. It appears that one of these groups was coming here to prevent us from being attacked by the other group.
And evidently they did. Or were we attacked and we don't know about it?
Well, yeah, you know, and this has actually been sort of, before I ever mentioned any of this, and this is the first time I've ever vocalized this opinion. It's one of the findings in the book. So, you know, you've got a first here, Jerry, and I don't think I certainly haven't heard anyone else, any other researcher, expound this theory. But before I brought this theory up in public, this is about a year and a half ago, I spoke to, you know, I have some very good Native American connections. And from some groups, they've actually confirmed that, yes, there is some type of war going on right now, as we speak, still going on, between extraterrestrial forces who are at odds as to, you know, us. I don't know all the details. It's about as much information as I have been able to confirm from different groups. But apparently this is the case.
So you're saying that the good guys, the good ETs and the bad ETs are battling somewhere over us, or we're just part of a, maybe like an island?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you... Yeah,
it's seized territory.
Well, again, if you look at the way that things transpired, it would appear that if the first group was coming from Hale Bob, it would seem that the second group was probably a lot more technologically advanced, because they didn't travel through regular space and time. They traveled on a gamma ray burst, light wave, or warping of space time. Gamma ray bursts are probably, and physicists, we can get into a big argument about this someday, but the gamma ray bursts explosions that are occurring are probably the evidence of extraterrestrial propulsion systems. Not all of them, but at least some of them. And it appears that the second group that came on the gamma ray burst light wave, which is February 28, 1997, I would assume would be the more advanced of the two species. And that this group is probably the one that was coming to save us, because it seems like, you know, the other group was traveling through regular space-time like we would send a rocket, apparently traveling along with the comet, which was discovered, like I said, all the way out by Jupiter in 1995, which is like the farthest away that a comet's really ever been detected. There are a lot of other anomalies about the comet that we can get into, but I want to stay on point. So, it appears that whatever second group this was, the February 28th, 1997 gamma ray group, is probably the good ones, and that they sort of sent an emergency OA team in to stop whatever the other group was trying to do. And again, this is just speculation. I mean, this is what, I'm looking at all the evidence and trying to figure out what's really going on behind the scenes, and this is what it's telling.
Our guest is William Warwick. We're going to take a break and we'll come back, and I think I have a hunch some of this ties into some of the Phoenix Lights. We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin. Marvelous Marv Grand Canyon Tours offers you a unique look at one of the great wonders of the world, the Grand Canyon.
Been at the Grand Canyon area most of my life, so pretty much grew up in the area and know quite a few things that the common tourist doesn't know. And I need to avoid all the people and stuff and try to take them to secluded areas.
A day excursion, personally, conducted by Marvelous Marv.
Yeah, we start at about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're done about 4:30. Absolutely. And I have a little photo CD disc for him with 1,000 of my favorite pictures and some video. And
no other tour offers so much. And no other personalized tour offers a better price.
No, I'm still the same, and I'm the most reasonable price tour of the Grand Canyon now. $85 a person. Yeah. Yeah.
Call 928-707-0291 or check him out at Marvelous Marv.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings. experiences. Hear about it on the Jerry Pippin Show.
We're talking about using Hale Bopp as a vehicle to travel through space, or maybe we're talking about just using it as a subterfuge. I don't know, William, and I don't guess any of us know.
Well, I do actually have a couple okay. of them on that. One, first of all, if you're going to make an intergalactic journey, any kind of journey through space, the most precious water, and comets are, you know, big ice balls. So in addition to the water, they also have a lot of organic elements, carbon, and maybe some other molecules that could definitely be used for all kinds of things in space, for living and for food and that kind of thing. The other possible-ish benefit, I should say, of traveling along with or behind a comet is that it has, if in space, of course, there's gravity, and if this comet is large enough, the vehicle which is traveling with it could be caught in its gravity well. And if that's the case, then, of course, it would just be just like we would catch a hitchhiker would catch a ride, then a spacecraft could theoretically catch a ride behind the comet or in the comet's tail and be captured in its gravity if the comet is big enough. The third benefit, so, you know, that's the second benefit. The third benefit, of course, is when you travel through interstellar space, you're going to invariably come across micrometeorites and dust particles and that kind of thing that, you know, traveling at, you know, 25,000 miles an hour or what have you could kind of ruin your day. So if you have a huge, relatively large ice ball traveling some distance in front of you, that could actually act as sort of a snowplow to catch any kind of debris or material that might destroy your spacecraft. So, in fact, that on one hand, you might think that it sounds ludicrous that any kind of spacecraft would want to travel along with or behind or close to a cometary object. In fact, if you really think about it, there are probably some really good reasons why you would want to do that.
It would be somewhat akin to sailboats riding the trade winds.
Absolutely. Or even if you've, and again, the physics is different, obviously, because there's, but yeah, you get the idea. That's a good analogy.
Let's talk about the Phoenix Lights a little bit more. It's pretty hard to switch subjects when you talk about something as incredible as what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
You still have open lines of communication with somebody that knows about this battle?
Yes, so far. I mean, right after this interview comes out. But, I wouldn't exactly say it's top secret information. I mean, some Native American tribes have been sort of saying this to people that they trust for quite some time now. The information that I received was that this is, in fact, what has happened. From a different perspective, we interviewed Three Spirit Wolf, who is a Native American storyteller, just this past February, and this relates to the Phoenix Lights and the Native American and the UFO connection. And I had heard stories, although no one had actually told me personally, but I've heard rumors or stories that area of Phoenix in particular was a hotbed of UFO activity. And that a lot of the petroglyphs that are in that area, for instance, in the Deer Valley Museum, Petroglyph Park, I should say, in Glendale, where we had our conference, they have numerous depictions that would appear to look like, some of them are even triangle-shaped, by the way, or boomerang-shaped, that depict people coming from, you know, UFO-type-looking craft. And during the interview with Priscilla, that's her English name, Priscilla Wolf, she indicated to us that, in fact, the boomerangs that were seen in Phoenix in 1997 in March were actually the return of the extraterrestrials that the Hohokam tribe, which is a tribe that Hohokam actually means vanished ones, had lived. The Hohokam tribe lived in the Phoenix area. So basically, 1,000 years ago, these Hohokam tribes people had some type of interaction with these extraterrestrials and left with them, hence the term Hohokam, which means vanishing ones, and that these UFOs that we saw in March, at least the good ones, I guess, hopefully, were the return, in fact, of the same extraterrestrials that they had interactions with 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, a lot of things happen around Phoenix, no doubt about it. That's the only place I've ever seen a UFO. And down there investigating the whole spate of sightings, really, as you mentioned at the top of the broadcast.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it appears to be what we would call Stargate. There are certain locations around the Earth where the space-time matrix probably collapses, and this gets really detailed in the book. It's probably a lot more than I can even begin to hope to describe over the phone. But basically, if you take the idea of sort of Richard Hoagland's group, which is the star tetrahedron within the sphere, hyperdimensional fields, you know, again, you can call them whatever you want, but basically there appears to be certain points around the Earth where these events seem to occur with more frequency than others, and hence you can sort of come to the conclusion that these areas are what we would call stargates. And they happen in a sort of geometric pattern in regular places all around the Earth. They've been fairly documented fairly well. I do go into a great deal of documentation in my book, of course, which is much more than we can do on the phone. But basically, it appears that this Norfolk area right here, Norfolk, Virginia Beach area, and the Phoenix area are actually connected somehow in the sense that they are stargates where you can either conduct experiments or where extraterrestrial craft would, I guess, come through the wormhole or whatever you want to call it. But there is definitely a connection I have found between the Norfolk area and Phoenix, and it goes back all the way to Roswell. One of the most interesting stories that I came across recently was that on July 8, 1947 was when Roswell occurred, because that's in New Mexico, so when I say the Phoenix area, I mean that general area. Roswell occurred on July 8, 1947. I found an article on July 9, 1947 in Norfolk, Virginia, which is where I saw my boomerang UFO, if you compare it to the original Roswell record account, the description of the devices is similar. They were football-shaped. And I was just shocked to have found that and to read that. And apparently the July 9th, 1947, which came along with the photograph, by the way, in the local newspaper here, was not aware of the Roswell incident. So, you know, the young man who that story was based on and gave the description of the UFO that he saw the day after Roswell really didn't know anything about Roswell.
You know, you talk about that time frame, 47 into the 50s. A lot of these UFO pictures and things ended up on front pages of local newspapers around the country.
Yeah, Rob Simone's got a great book out if you can get a hold of it. Gosh, I can't remember the name.
Yeah, right. And we've talked to him about it. And we've looked at the book. It's incredible. It's just newspaper clippings of incidents and photographs.
One thing about a lot of the stuff that was seen prior to, say, I don't know, the 1990s, maybe even the 80s. I mean, there's no question that probably 70% of the objects which were seen unquestionably were just secret government projects. And the Blue Book kind of says this too, and I think a lot of the studies that have been done show this in general, that, you know, 70 to 80% of the sightings are explainable, maybe 10% are questionable, and maybe a core 5% are actually, you know, just really kind of unexplainable totally. It's nice to see, you know, someone who's actually documented all that and got it in one place, you know, so we can go back and look at that stuff and try and make correlations that we may not have even known existed before.
You're right. We're going to talk in detail about some of the people involved with the Phoenix Lights when we come back. I'm basically thinking about Governor Symington. I want to get your take on that.
Yes, yes.
First of all, let's plug the movie again. It premieres at the film festival there in New York this weekend.
February 20th at the East Village Theater. And tickets are, I think, $12 to $15. They're a little bit cheaper if you buy them online at newyorkfilmandvideo.com. And this is part of the New York Film Festival.
And the DVD is available, and we have links to a couple of places where they can buy it. I'll be right back.
Hi, this is Rod C. Davis. I have a question. Do you love to travel? Then you need to check out YTV's weekly travel deals and steals. Just go to the Travel Store and More banner, click on the Business and Vacation Travel link, and then sign up for the Deals and Steals newsletter for great deals every week to America's favorite vacation spots. And while you're logged on, you can send flowers to that special person, buy your perfect car, buy tickets to attractions, book an exotic hunting or fishing trip, set up a honeymoon registry, and much more. Just click on the extras link and take advantage of YTB's huge purchasing power that saves you money. And if you'd like to save a lot of money on your travel, then check out the Travel Business Opportunity link and find out how you could earn a commission each and every time that you book a trip. You can be sure that Travelocity, Orbitz, and Expedia won't do that. Click on the banner and bookmark the page for your future use. You can save money and...
William Warrick is our guest, and the name of the documentary is The Phoenix Incident. And in that documentary, you bring up a Special Operations Flight Troubleshooter 615. Tell our audience what we're talking about.
Troubleshooter 615 was a Navy SEAL team that was apparently dropped off, forming a crew was dropped off at Dam Neck Base here in Norfolk sometime in the evening of March 13th, 1997, which was less than 24 hours after I had saw my UFO, my boomerang UFO, also in Norfolk, Virginia, although at a different location close to the Norfolk Naval Air Station. And apparently from the reports that I've read, the ones that have been published at least, the Troubleshooter 615 was on its way back to land on a little crew carrier, a tender ship, I don't recall the name of it, but they were going to land on the backside of this small frigate, and for some unknown reason, they basically crashed into the ocean, and all four men died. Now, the importance of this particular event is the time. And the time of this event was at 11:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The interesting thing about that, is when you correlate that time to the time period, the actual time of the Phoenix Lights, it means that the Troubleshooter 615 crashed basically simultaneously with the height of the Phoenix Lights. And since we're talking about both of these places being some sort of stargate or area where UFOs can come and go at will or travel through certain points, you know, maybe island hopping from one point to another point, that something happened, perhaps there was an object over the frigate which the air crew didn't see until the last minute and executed a course correction. And when they did so, they weren't able to recover from it, crashed into the ocean. And that's how Troubleshooter 615...
Yeah, I get the connection. Speaking of that, did any satellite pictures or radar pictures of this UFO activity in 1997?
There are. None that I have seen from March 13th, 1997, but the satellite that would have been covering that, which was the Mystery.
Yeah, that was
satellite.
Down. What's the deal there?
Yeah. Well, apparently that was actually taken out many hours before any of these events started to transpire on the East Coast with Troubleshooter 615 or with the Phoenix events in Phoenix 2 hours later. I take that back. It actually happened simultaneously because 9:20 p.m. in Phoenix was 11:20 p.m. Off 80 miles off the coast of Norfolk. So, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, yeah, basically the radar and satellite pictures, and we're talking about that satellite going down.
Yeah. The Misty 3 satellite apparently was, when I say taken out, I don't mean destroyed. The report is from the manufacturer Spectrum Astro was that the batteries were actually drained, that an object, a spaceborne object, had apparently hovered over this particular satellite, which has a bunch of miniature sensors on it, you know, so you get infrared and ultraviolet and all kinds of other sensors. That broad spectrum sensory package, which covered the North American continent, or parts of the North American continent, had its batteries drained and was completely disabled. So that if an object, say a boomerang-shaped object, which for all intents and purposes, if you saw it at low altitude, would look like a cigar-shaped object unless you saw it from below, then perhaps that boomerangs or multiple boomerangs were on the North American continent. They knocked out that satellite so that we couldn't see them from above, and then they shadowed that frigate so that when the Troubleshooter 615 guys were coming in, the standard operating procedures take off the night vision goggles, and they perhaps did not see that object until the last minute because that ship's radars are pointing out towards the horizon. They don't point straight up. And so possibly that's what that boomerang was doing, and it might explain what happened at Troubleshooter 615, as well as why the satellites would have been taken out and disabled.
If I'm reading between the lines something that that's not there, tell me, but it seems to me like you think there might have been a battle going on between these two entities of the ETs at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, if you really want to throw the third wild card in there, it's us trying to maybe shoot down them. In fact, at the X conference, I had a short conversation with Paul Hellyer, who is one of the most distinguished diplomats
right.
in Canada. And, I mean, he said point blank that the rest of the country within the inner circles of the defense establishments are very concerned that our cowboy president there is going to start a conflict that he can't control. And they're very concerned about this. And although he wasn't in power, of course, in 1997, I mean, obviously the implication is that we need to be very careful about who we go and try and shoot down.
Now let's talk about Governor Simon.
Yes.
That's pretty incredible if you stop and think about it. He makes fun of it right after it happens, and then later he says, "Well, I was just trying to stop a panic."
Yeah.
What do you
think
of that?
I was given the information about Governor Symington a couple of weeks before I did my initial interview with you, and I don't know if you recall, you were pressing me on something, and I told you I really couldn't talk about it. I promised James Fox and Leslie Keene that I wouldn't break the story until they did, because they're the ones who did all the work, and they deserve that. But originally that story was supposed to break on the anniversary, which was March 13th, 2007, the 10-year anniversary, and they had some trouble getting some media outlets to cover it. And unfortunately, I mean, it did get on CNN, but it was a, you know, a 2.5-minute blurb from Anderson Cooper. And that was it. I mean, and there were some other things, but that was basically it. A lot of us, myself included, I confirmed that the story was true. And I, you know, didn't want to talk about it. Like I said, it was their story to break.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I was like, when I initially heard it, I thought, this can't be true. I mean, you're talking about the man who spoofed and scoffed and made a fool of anyone that made a report about what they saw. I'm not talking about lights in the sky. I'm talking about solid boomerang and triangular-shaped objects. And here he is coming out 10 years later and saying, yeah, I did see something. And not only that, but, I mean, in the Anderson Cooper interview, he basically defied the United States military to prove that it wasn't a military craft. And here, and he's a decorated Air Force pilot from the Vietnam War, combat pilot. You know, so he's a qualified observer. He's a government official, and he's probably the most important person who could have made a difference in that case had he, you know, come forward and said, yes, I did see. I mean, if he had said what he said in 2007, if he had said that in 1997, God, I mean, I don't know where this case would be, but because he did that whole spoof and called the quote-unquote emergency press conference, which was supposed to be for state emergencies, and all the press showed up and he made a spoof of it, I mean, that the story essentially pretty much died right there as far as the mainstream media is concerned.
Reconstructing all of this, what do you make of it?
This is the Symington thing. Here's the thing about Symington, okay? Well, and I don't think a lot of people know this, but that he, or realize this, but he was under indictment at the time.
Yes.
By the federal government.
I remember.
In fact, you know, from talking to Mike Fortson and Francis Barward, apparently he was actually in court.
Well, I think he was coming down the steps of the courthouse and somebody asked him something.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, he goes into the courtroom, and I guess it's a 3 or 4 hour, you know, closed chamber meeting with the judge. And then he comes out and announces that he's going to, you know, this emergency press conference. And Francis Barward points this out in our documentary, and it's really, really, you know, it makes sense. How did he have time to put together the conference, to get the alien makeup and costume and all the rest of that stuff while he was in judge's chambers and was excommunication from everybody? And yet he had time to come out and do all that within just an hour or two. It was so...
So you think he was following a script somebody wrote for him?
When he got in that judge's chambers, I'm sure that he was told exactly what to say and exactly what to do, and he did it. Or else.
Yeah, he was under indictment at the time.
Under the time, and after he beat that, the guy's beat three indictments, and from what I understand, it's a lot of bull. It never should have happened in the first place. But that's politics, and there's nothing worse than national politics except for state politics or local politics.
Now, he had a famous uncle in the Truman administration, I think.
There you go. In fact, one of your producers was the one that brought that to my attention.
The Simonton connection is actually very intriguing because as your producer had sent me an email back in 2007, apparently the uncle or cousin or relation of Fife Symington III was Stuart Symington.
Yeah, he was actually the first Secretary of the Air Force.
And he had an interaction with Secretary Forrestal, who later committed suicide. And apparently Stuart Symington had met with Secretary Forrestal in Holby Sound, which is the same area where President Clinton allegedly injured his knee in 1997 during the Phoenix Lights. And like Forrestal before him, Clinton was taken to the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And the only difference is that Clinton had surgery on his knee and Secretary Forrestal allegedly committed suicide. So it's an interesting sort of, almost like an echo of the events that happened in 1997, except that, apparently no one was killed during that incident. But it's interesting to note that the injuries that were sustained by Clinton were right around the time that the Phoenix Lights were occurring, basically simultaneously. And I have to wonder if Clinton and Symington didn't talk that night. Is that apparently in the early 1960s, Governor Symington, who wasn't governor then, of course, but in the 1960s, Fife Symington actually saved Bill Clinton's life when Bill Clinton and Symington were in New England at a beach party, and Clinton got in some trouble and apparently saved Clinton from drowning. Yeah. And then, of course, if you look at what happened with Symington being indicted by the government and none of the indictments would stick, and the possibility that, you know, he was basically told by the government, you know, what to do. In fact, if you look at the spoof that he did with CNN, if you look at it very carefully, he's not speaking from the heart. He's reading a written statement, and his head is down, and he doesn't pick his head up till he's done reading each particular sentence in his statement. So, that again, it's just another sort of circumstantial evidence that points out to me that he was probably, even though he may say it was of his own volition, I don't really believe that. I think that he was basically told, you're not going to talk about this, and if you talk about it, we're going to throw you in jail. You know, we're going to convict you on the charges that we trumped up against you in the first place, basically. And there's one more thing that I don't think we got to mention. As if all of that wasn't enough to connect Clinton with Symington, one of the very last things that Bill Clinton did when he was leaving office was to give Fife Symington a presidential pardon for all past and apparently current indictments which were going to be forged against him again. And so perhaps this was sort of payback to Symington for not disclosing the UFO information and vice versa.
Well, that pardon by Clinton would certainly allow Symington to come clean on the UFO issue.
Absolutely, absolutely. I didn't even think of that. That's pretty good, Jerk. I didn't even think of that.
Okay.
I love when I do these interviews because, you know, there's always some kind of angle that I didn't think of before, and I go, oh, my God,
You told me before that you thought the Secret Service was rushing Clinton around to protect him because they thought we were under attack, and maybe we were.
The story just gets even more bizarre. Now, I'll kind of try to tie all this in together and expound on a little bit more. But, yeah, at 11:20 p.m., you have the crash of Troubleshooter 615 off the east coast of Norfolk. At 11:30 p.m., President Clinton allegedly injures his knee in Hobie Sound while he's visiting the golfer Greg Norman. So this is 10 minutes after Troubleshooter 615. these two events are simultaneous to what is happening in Phoenix, which is the UFO explosion that's going on. And so when you take the, you know, the 11:30 p.m. time period and you correlate that to Phoenix time, they are simultaneous events, even though they are 2 hours
different.
Well,
they may have been. Yeah, from your information, what you say?
Yeah. Well, you had the disabling of the MSTY 3 satellite, which NORAD probably would have been troubled by. Then you have the numerous reports of going on in Phoenix. Okay, a couple hours after that. Then, simultaneous with those reports in Phoenix, you have Troubleshooter 615, which crashes into the middle of the Atlantic, which probably sent alarm bells up. And then, simultaneous with that, all those events, you have, the alleged injury of President Clinton injuring his knee. Yeah, I think that the alarm bells went off after Troubleshooter 615 went down, and that they thought they were under attack and went to DEFCON 2. Oh, this happened, this didn't just happen on March 13th, this happened also later on in April. When Craig Button's A-10, Craig Button's, you know, the loss of the A-10.
The pilot that went berserk, supposedly.
Supposedly, allegedly, yeah. There's no evidence for that. But, one of the things that we found out was that he may not have been in control of his aircraft. That there are reports, there are some government officials who were contacted basically were told by the pilots that they were not in control of their aircraft. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means that, you know, a UFO came in and, you know, somehow took control of their aircraft, or if it means that there is something more nefarious going on where I think this is leading, is that there is a group that obviously is responsible for putting up the disinformation about these things, and for whatever reason, whether Craig Button knew about the flare drops or saw a UFO or intercepted a UFO or however he was involved in this, meaning the Phoenix Lights.
You know, that happened some time back, but Lynn Swoboda, she's involved in this story somehow.
It just gets, you know, more and more sinister. Both of these pilots, Amy Lynn Swoboda was, from what I understand, all the information that I could get, was Craig Button's trainer. Craig Button was in the Davis-Monthan base to train with his A-10 for, I think, about 6, 7, 8 weeks or something like that. And his trainer was Amy Lynn Swoboda. So you got the March 13th Phoenix lights, which the government says were dropped by a visiting A-10 air squadron, happening on March 13th, 1997. Then 2 weeks later, on April 2nd, 1997, in the middle of daytime, you have an A-10 pilot from the same base that the government says dropped the flares. Okay, it's from the same planes that dropped the flares, okay? Craig Button on April 2nd takes off and disappears and allegedly flies his million-dollar aircraft into the side of a mountain in the middle of the daytime.
Right.
800 miles from his base. Then you have on May 27th, 1997, again, just 6 weeks after that, maybe 8 or 9 weeks after the Phoenix lights, you have his trainer dies in a quote-unquote accident. And in fact, if you go back and look at the record, there are six, eight, ten crashes.
No, you're right. I don't think we lost A-10s that many in Desert Storm.
I mean, we may have lost one. I believe there was one pilot that got shot down, but I'm not positive about that. But again, that was a combat operation, and none of these other things were. And I document, there were 20 or 30 plane crashes like this, that if you really look into the details of it, you go, what is going on? There was one particular plane crash between a German and an American American C-130, it was a spy plane, basically, and another German plane, which is also a spy plane, in the middle of the daytime, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, off the coast of Africa. Now, how have two of the most sophisticated wartime airplanes with the most sophisticated equipment known to man crash in the middle of the daytime over the middle of the Atlantic Ocean?
Are you saying they're victims because of a UFO cover-up, or did the UFOs and the ETs do it, or do we know?
The ETs, we had orders to stand down. In July of 1997, for the first time in history, in Norfolk Naval Air Station, all five U.S. aircraft carriers were reported. That's the first time it's happened. I don't think it's happened since, but that's the first time it happened since Pearl Harbor. And I get the distinct impression, and also, two times, and once in 1996 and late 1996, again in September of 1997, after that incident that I just told you about with the German and the American C-130s crashing, the U.S. military and the U.S. Air Force had a stand-down of all non-combat air operations. and that's the first time, although those two times are the first two times that that's ever happened, period, in the history of the Air Force. So, yeah, there's no question, I think, that they had. We were basically told, you know, you got to cool it off or we want to start taking planes out of the sky. I think that's what it boils down to. Even if they didn't have any communication, that's what happened.
Well, we're still here.
Yeah, well, and again, there are some crashes that have happened recently that may be related. But again, it's so difficult to tell unless you have a rash of them. I mean, back then in 1997, we had three or four crashes in one day. You know what I mean? So when you have that much, you know, evidence to sort of support the idea that something is going on, that our skies are occupied, and that military people are being, you know, killed either accidentally or inadvertently.
I mean, the war hog, the ATM, is basically a plane that attacks tanks and things. Why this particular type of aircraft?
Well,
the UFOs were involved, or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just a cover-up, and these people were going to talk, but why would they know?
I have two theories behind this.
Okay.
This ties back to the Phoenix Lights, which is kind of cool. The visiting Air 10 National Air Guard squadron that was supposedly the ones that would drop the flares, and I have no doubt that they did drop flares. The name of that particular operation was called Project Snowbird. Now, the really interesting thing about that is if you look back into the history and the declassified information about UFOs, excuse me one second, what you find is that Project Snowbird was a code word back in the 60s and the 50s for a operation which was conducted to make people believe that secret aircraft were in fact UFOs.
Really? I didn't know about that.
Absolutely. And so, you know, what's the difference between 1950 and 1997? I don't think there's any difference. I think that there was a visiting Air 10 squadron from Maryland, like they said, who was sent up to the sky to conduct the air operations and told to drop flares, and as part of their quote-unquote training. And they probably had no idea what was going on. And this was all part of a sophisticated cover story. I think that Craig Button's A-10 probably was in the sky that night as well, perhaps participating in some other exercises just as the other A-10s were. And that if the reports that they were not in control of their aircraft, meaning that someone else was controlling their aircraft remotely, are true, then perhaps, and again, this is just speculation, I don't have any concrete evidence, but I'm just trying to put the pieces together, perhaps Craig Button's A-10 was remotely controlled in such a way that it dropped those flares in an ascending sort of boomerang-shaped pattern, which is what gave us the 9:20 p.m. flare story in the now infamous video. And the reason I say all that is because from what I understand, and I could be wrong, but from what I understand, even the own military's report about the visiting A-10 National Guard and the flares says that those planes were back on the tarmac by about 8:30 p.m. Now, that raises a very important conflicting problem, and that's that the 9:20 p.m. video of the flares obviously could not have been dropped by them. But if that particular squadron and those men were sent up to do a training exercise and were told to fly a certain pattern with the lights on and with lights off and dropping flares and not dropping flares, then this could be part of what they called Project Snowbird, because that's what they said that's what it was. You know,
mm-hmm.
Whatever, you know, that was the name of the exercise.
Do you think most of these A-10 crashes that happened around this time were involved with the same planes, same equipment that were involved in the Snowbird thing?
You know,
there's only way to prove that. I don't know.
Now that you mentioned that, you just got me thinking about an angle that I hadn't really thought of. Well, let's think about this for a second. Let's just assume that it wasn't just that Craig Button's A-10 that was tampered with. Let's suppose that they had other A-10s at other bases who were set up with the same equipment, the same software, which would allow someone to take control of the airplane in case a UFO flap occurs somewhere other than Phoenix.
They got a good point there, and I think there's a lot of evidence that you can take control of airplanes by remote control.
Look, all of it's fly-by-wire. Every plane made today is fly-by-wire. All you got to do is change the harness pack out and change, you know, the computer pack out. And I'm sure that can be done. There's no question that it can be done because there's not a direct control linkage between the pilot and the control surfaces. So, you know, most of the planes that you fly in today, all the pilot does is pull back on the yoke and take off and then drive for 5 or 6 hours and then, you know, land, and that's it. That's all they do. They monitor systems. That's about it. So, yeah, I mean, there's no question that the technology existed. It's existed for 20 or 30 years at the minimum. They may have had some trouble incorporating into each individual particular avionics system, and that may be the reason why some of these plane crashes occurred. In fact, I do know that there was some sort of new update to the radar, ground tracking radar system that they had, the avionics system they had, but I'm not completely versed on it as well as I probably should be. But
I understand what you're saying. We only have about 5 minutes left. Edgar Cayce comes into this. tell me about that. We talked a little bit about this before.
Yeah, you know, and this is really more fascinating to me than a lot of the other stuff. Basically, Edgar Cayce, how do I explain this real quickly? He moved all around the country trying to find a place that he felt that his psychic abilities would be enhanced. He found a place in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I later found after my UFO encounter that the latitude where I saw my UFO encounter was exactly the same latitude as where Cayce located his facility. And this was important because I read a book, again, after my UFO encounter by a gentleman named Bruce Caffey, who was a pilot from New Zealand, who wrote a book called The Harmonic Conquest of Space. And in that book, he basically says that, and talks about Edgar Cayce in this particular location that both my UFO event and Cayce located his hospital at in Virginia Beach, that at this particular latitude, you could conduct, this was a sort of harmonic sort of stargate point, where, you know, UFOs and other things are seen. And so it really just blew me away that here's this guy who writes this book in 1969, Bruce Caffey, talking about this harmonic stargate point, which is at exactly the same latitude where I saw my UFO in Norfolk. And he correlates that with Edgar Cayce, who located his hospital exactly the same latitude point. Now, it appears that Cayce's psychic abilities allowed him to sense these other hyperdimensional fields, let's call them, where these stargates might be more easily created, let's put it that way. And so, it appears that in 1925, Cayce was the one that found the location where these sort of tests could be conducted. Well, later on, it seems that, and this is where the Philadelphia experiment comes in, apparently, the Philadelphia experiment, Project Rainbow, occurred at exactly that same latitude, not too far from where I saw my UFO. And when I went back and looked at records from the 1950s, a couple of important ones, the Nash Fortenberry sighting, and there was a couple of other ones in 1952, July 16th, where the UFO paths that the UFOs took all seemed to originate or end right around this same area where I saw my UFO, which is where the Philadelphia experiment allegedly took place. So the Edgar Cayce connection to all this is that this psychic who lived, 75 years ago, was able to sense, apparently, the area that was best to conduct these experiments at, time and space experiments, et cetera, et cetera, manipulating the gravitational forces around the Earth. And so all of these incredible things that we learned about can possibly or might be possibly traced back to Edgar Cayce, which is
it
amazing.
Is. We only have a couple of minutes left. We want to mention the documentary and the premiere again in New York, and we will before we get off. And also, you can pick up that DVD for $20 and the postage from a couple of websites. Go ahead and give those for the people listening on iPods.
Absolutely. It's www.seriousseminars.com, and Sirius is spelled like the star Sirius, which is S-I-R-I-U-S, seminars.com. You can also link to UFOeyewitness.com, and that will also give you a link where you can purchase the DVD as well.
You're the one who brought this up at the first about the battle maybe going on, and we're either involved by trying to shoot down one group or another, or we're just the catch. What happened to that group with the Hale-Bopp comet? Are they still traveling through space, or did they drop off here, or what happened?
I don't know. I think.
I mean, we're still here 11 years later.
Yeah, we're still here. The Native Americans, just about everyone that I've spoken to, says that 2012 we will have our answer. And this, of course, relates to the Mayan, you know, end count of 13. It's also interesting that when you take the Mayan end date of, it's actually, if you write it down, it's 13.0.0.0.0. And all of these UFO events tend to occur on the 13th. In fact, besides the Phoenix Lights incidents, which occurred on the March 13th, Dim Tillitesso did a spectral analysis of the lights from that night. Some of the lights, not all of them, I don't think, not the ones, the flare drops, but at any rate, he found that some of the lights matched the Fatima lights in 1917 in Portugal.
And we've done shows about the Lady of Fatima, and maybe there was UFO intervention there.
Yeah, that was a great show. So, you know, maybe this is that particular extraterrestrial group, or at least one of these groups is that particular extraterrestrial group. And the other one...
You think anything's going to be happening this year?
Well, you know, look, you had Stevensville in January. You had a huge flap going on in England all summer long. I mean, just unbelievable stories coming out of England right now, and videos and everything. And if you just go on YouTube, they've got, you know, F-16s from Israel and all kinds of different defense countries who are chasing these orbs. And I mean, America needs to wake up, okay? You know, something's going on, and we need to pay attention to it. And if we don't, I think we're going to be in big trouble.
That's the way we're going to have to leave the show.
Yeah.
William Warwick, good luck with your documentary, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
It's been great, Jerry. Really appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.